Hey, this is CO Dave Brass, also known as Blake Robbins. You better be listening to Inside Oz, or I'm going to take you down to Unit B and rough you up a little bit.
Sister, you do not want to see my anger. My anger is massive, all-encompassing.
Being accused of three disses, disloyal, dishonest, disrespectful.
I don't disagree that there's evil in the world. I do disagree that we're powerless against it.
You know, if I was a girl, you'd get tough.
If you was a girl, so you'd be butt-ass ugly.
She's getting married? To a Bobby?
No, not a Bobby, Tim. He's a guard. He guards the queen.
Yeah, well, then I can see how they've got a lot in fucking common!
Try to find the common thing that binds us all.
Right.
Crime is the common thing. See, we are all of us back there. Even you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Inside Oz, the original Oz Review podcast. As always, I'm your host, Neil Thompson. A couple of bits of business to take care of at the top of this episode. First off, I just want to say a big thank you to Blake Robbins for supplying that introduction that you heard at the beginning of the episode. We sorted that out quite a while back, but I knew that it was something that I wanted to use. Blake gave me a bunch of different possible intros to use. He was great. Really accommodating with what I was looking for. And I just wanted to say thank you to Blake for that. Be sure to go and give him a follow on Instagram at blake.robbins. He's really approachable on there and seemingly happy to answer any questions. And you can find out all about his writing, producing and directing work that he's done since the show's conclusion. So do go and give him a follow. As I'm recording this introduction as well, we're a few days removed from the announcement of the death of O.J. Simpson, who long-time listeners will know I have, I wouldn't call it an obsession, but definitely an increased interest in the man. Especially with regards to his run-ins with the law from in and around the time of the show's broadcast. OJ Watch has been a semi-regular segment on the podcast for the last couple of series, but due to his death it would appear that the time is perhaps right to retire the segment. In closing, and as I did on social media following the announcement, I'll sum up his crime legacy with something that was mentioned on a previous episode. I'm not saying that OJ Simpson did murder his ex-wife and a lover, but I will say that there is no evidence to suggest that anybody else did. So long, O.J. Simpson, and good riddance.
Mail!
Finally, it's time to dip into the mailbag and address the elephant in the room as regards to the time between the last two episodes. A number of you reached out with questions such as, is everything okay? And are you still alive? Don't worry, folks, I'm not speaking to you from beyond the grave. That's something we'll cover in a different aspect in a future episode. All that happened was that, with me finishing the previous episode and beginning work on this one towards the end of 2023, things just got a little out of kilter and, as Adam Easy would say, I just lost my balance. But, we're back now to discuss today's episode, Series 4, Episode 15, Even the Score. Holding an 8.1 on IMDb, the lowest rated episode for the entire of Series 4, the episode was written by Tom Fontana, Sunil Nair and Sean Weitzel, and was directed by J. Miller Tobin, returning to the show to direct for the first time since Series 4, Episode 7, A Town Without Pity. The episode originally aired on February 18th, 2001, and scored a 3.72 in viewership, up ever so slightly from the previous episode, and a 2.4 in the household rating, which is down ever so slightly from the previous episode. Also on this day, tragedy struck the Daytona 500 race when, at the age of 49, seven-time Winston Cup winner Dale Earnhardt was killed following a three-car pileup on the final lap of the race. Following a number of investigations, and much like Formula One in 1994 following the death of Ayrton Senna, the sport would implement a number of new safety procedures going forward.
Ah, competition brings out the best in people. That's what they say. When a game is on the line, a true sportsman wants the outcome to rest on his shoulders. The logic being, you make the winning play, you walk away a hero. Of course, if you fuck up, you're the GOAT. Problem with competition here in Oz is, we mostly got GOATs.
Kick off with Act 1, which sees Augustus in front of a scoreboard talking about how competition brings out the best in people. Or at least that's what they say. and that when a game is on the line, a true sportsman wants the outcome to rest on their shoulders. Logic being that if you make the winning play, then you walk away the hero. Then again, were you to fuck up, then suddenly you're the GOAT. Something that most of the men in Oz can be classified as. The term GOAT has changed over time. Augustus is using it here to refer to a scapegoat. Whereas these days, if you're referred to as a GOAT, it means that you're the greatest of all time, hence GOAT. The referee's whistle blows as we go to M City, where a new contestant is ready to play Up Your Ante. Not that John Carpenter, having departed last episode after failing to answer the top prize question. Today's player then, Journey Kennedy, who doesn't appear to be anyone of note, is being helped through the game by Bill Boggs, who Gordon Elliott tells us is a man who's done just about everything, but is perhaps best known for being a television presenter in his own right, hosting his own talk show, Southern Exposure, in the 1970s, as well as hosting the game show All Star Anything Goes, a US retooling of Britain's It's a Knockout. The first question then, which unsurprisingly is based on sports, sees Gordon asking in basketball, what does it mean when a referee makes this motion? Not ideal, I know, podcasting being a predominantly audio-based medium, but he rolls his clenched fists over each other in a peddling motion. Bill Boggs thinks it means that the referee wants to do the hustle. No jokes, please, Mr. Boggs, that's my domain. As we pan across Beecher, Ryan and others watching the show, finding his joke about as funny as I did. Journey admits that she doesn't follow basketball, and to be honest, neither do I, but I'm fairly sure the answer here is for a call of travelling. As we move away from the screens where a suspicious-looking Omar emerges from underneath the drug-taking stairs. Chico notices Omar and makes his way over to confront him, Omar taking a bump of some drugs in plain sight of any staff rather than having just done so underneath the stairs. Surely that's why you go under the stairs in the first place. You don't come out in plain sight and just do it in front of anybody who might catch you. Chico approaches, asking how Omar is feeling, Omar saying that he's feeling pretty good. But Chico mentions that he still feels aches and pains from when Omar stabbed him, the incident occurring in the kitchen back in Season 4, Episode 10, after Chico called Omar the N-word. Omar half-heartedly apologises, which Chico isn't buying, as Omar then pulls a "sorry you didn't die." But rather than having a fight break out as you would usually expect it to, we cut to the crime flashback of Carmine Guerra, aka Chico, which has been a long time coming, with Chico having been on the show since the middle of Series 2. As I've mentioned in passing since he first appeared, Chico is played by Otto Sanchez. A native New Yorker, growing up in Jackson Heights, Otto pursued qualifications in advertising design at New York's Fashion Institute of Technology, and later earned a scholarship at Columbus College of Art and Design, before shifting his focus to theatre acting, moving back to New York from Ohio in 1991 to study at the HB Studio under Janine Kaplan and Austin Pendleton, known to us as William Giles. Earning his first television acting credit in 1997 for a minor role in the series Della Ventura, the role of Chico was Otto's first recurring role, and to this day is perhaps still his most well-known. After first appearing on Oz in 1998 during Series 2, Episode 4, Losing Your Appeal, Otto also appeared in the films Mute Love and Saturn, while between 1999 and 2000 he appeared in three episodes of Third Watch on NBC. In 2000, Otto appeared in the movie Overnight Sensation along with a number of his fellow Oz alumni, while in 2001 he appeared on TV in 100 Censor Street, as well as in the films Double Whammy and Dregs of Society. So Chico's crime flashback, this one being given the lovely blue colour filter treatment, sees him threatening to throw a man from the roof of a building. There's a lot of, "Whoa, gonna throw ya," as the man begs for him not to, but Chico eventually lets go and the man plummets to the floor below, Chico adding one last insult to proceedings by spitting on him from a great height. For this action, Chico is convicted of murder in the first degree and sentenced to 53 years, up for parole in 17. Looking back at this flashback, it just goes to show how attitudes, even as recent as the turn of the century, were very different, as the man that Chico throws off the building here is a dwarf, seemingly for no other reason than to get a cheap laugh. That could just be Chico being a bit of a dick, but there's absolutely no reason why this had to be a dwarf character. It doesn't add anything to proceedings. You could have told the exact same story using a person of quote-unquote regular height. It just seems to be a cheap joke. Hey, wouldn't it be funny if it was a dwarf that Chico killed? No, not really. Does it matter? As some of you may have already noticed as well, the actor playing the dwarf in question is none other than Peter Dinklage, appearing in a very early screen acting role. He goes uncredited as a member of the cast, but he is credited as a stunt performer in the closing credits. I won't go into too much of what he's done since, as this is very much a minor role for him, but he has of course gone on to have a very successful career in the years since, most famously for his role as Tyrion Lannister in Game of Thrones. So Chico heads to meet with McManus, who tries to brush Chico off, saying that he'll speak to him later, but Chico mentions that he wants to talk about Omar, referring to him as McManus' pet project, which gets McManus' attention. He says that Omar is still a tit man as McManus asks why Chico feels compelled to tell him this all of a sudden, sarcastically asking if it's out of some need to save his own soul. But Chico and McManus share a common ground, both men having been victims of an Omar shanking in the past. And Chico tells McManus that if Omar keeps using, then it'll only be a matter of time before he shanks someone else, suggesting that McManus should shake Omar down, implying that he'll find drugs if he does so. It's been a while since we've had a random shakedown, so this is actually a pretty smart move from Chico, as he can play it off as not being out of the realms of possibility, so fair play to him there. So the shakedown is called, Mino popping on his surgical gloves being a nice touch, and he heads straight for Omar, pulling him out of the line and finding some drugs in one of Omar's pockets. Despite what I said a moment ago, Chico draws attention to himself as he can't help but sport a smirk as Omar looks his way. He couldn't have made it any more obvious that he was the one behind this if he tried. Showing that fair is fair, Chico is also pulled out of the line and searched himself, Officer Armstrong finding Chico's own private stash hidden in his sock, mentioning that they've got themselves a double play, a baseball reference and keeping within the sport's theme. Chico has only got himself to blame there. He did a good job of planting the seed of calling for a shakedown by going to McManus to screw over Omar, only to then get cocky in thinking that he wouldn't get searched himself. So whatever punishment is to follow is his own fault. As Omar is escorted past, he gets into it a little with Chico, but it's all over with pretty quickly as Murphy calls for Chico to be put in the cage and for Omar to be taken to McManus. As Mino watches on from outside, a pissed off McManus tells Omar that they had a no-drugs agreement, and asks why he shouldn't FedEx Omar's arse off back to Solitary. Omar whines, saying that McManus has no reason not to, but that when it comes to drugs, Omar is, as he puts it, just a little shaky, and that God knows that he tries to stay on the straight and narrow, but the temptation just grows and grows until he just can't help it, and that he has to shove that shit where it doesn't belong. That's far from being a little shaky, Omar. Those are the words of a full-blown addict. Something which has been blindingly obvious more or less since he arrived at Oz, and something which Pete has referred to in the past. Contrast this scene with the one a few episodes back where Johnny went to Pete to confess that he himself was an addict. His confession was tinged with a lot more sadness in him admitting to himself that he had become an addict. Whereas Omar can't admit to himself what he is, grasping at weak justifications for his actions. McManus says that Omar thinks that he is a bubblehead, and how Omar makes the sorrowful face and tells McManus what he thinks he wants to hear, whereas he's actually full of shit, and that Omar can only try his patience so far, as he gives Omar another chance to go to Sister Pete's rehab session, something which Pete has informed McManus that Omar has tried to do before, but has been inconsistent in maintaining. As Omar goes to make another one of his excuses, McManus cuts him off and tells him that there is a session that afternoon and to be there before dismissing him from the office. One of the criticisms of McManus in this period of the show is that he continues to give Omar chance after chance, which is a fair point. He does give probably more than a normal person would do or should do, but we've spoken before and McManus has said himself that he isn't going to give up on Omar, as doing so would be an admission of failure. It's clear that McManus' patience is beginning to wear thin, however, and that's the crux of the issue in terms of the show overall. How many chances will someone get before it becomes clear that a particular method, in this case McManus' rehabilitation route, just isn't working? And if that doesn't work, then would a more forceful, repentant form of punishment be the way to go? At the drug counselling session, Verhue has the floor and says that the key is finding something to fill that time you would normally spend doing drugs with something else instead, which he isn't wrong about, but is probably easier said than done, especially in a place like Oz. Poet mentions about how that thing could be busting McManus' ass on the basketball court and shakes Verhue's hand. Clearly they're still riding the wave of satisfaction from the previous episode, as Beecher adds his two cents to proceedings, saying that activities are all fine and good, but it doesn't change what he calls the basic fact of a person won't be able to quit unless they want to, saying that you have to hit rock bottom before being able to crawl out again. As Beecher is saying that, he's looking in Omar's direction, which he takes to mean that Beecher was accusing him directly, which Beecher denies, saying that he was addressing the group as a whole. Now obviously we know that Beecher was speaking in broad terms here to the group. After all, he has to look somewhere. It's not like he can address everyone while looking at the ceiling or at the floor. But unfortunately, Omar was the one he decided to look at in particular, which has led to something else entirely, with Omar thinking that Beecher sees himself as being better than him because Beecher can quit and he can't. And as things get a little more heated, Omar gets to his feet and says that Beecher, instead of snorting drugs, has been sucking cock. Pete tries to defuse things, telling Omar that that's enough, as Omar goes to whip his lad out to tell Beecher to suck it, leading the Beecher retaliating by pushing Omar backwards, as a full-scale fight breaks out amongst everyone at the session, Ryan and Poet even managing to get into their own little fight, as Pete beats a hasty retreat. I love how she just gets down from the stage and throws her hands up, basically saying, "Fuck this shit, I'm out of here." As a result of this melee, everyone is carted off to the infirmary where they're all still throwing jabs at each other as Pete says to McManus that as a rule she doesn't give up on people, but that Omar may be the exception to the rule as McManus shouts Omar over. And there's some proper venom in his shout this time, his patience having worn even more thin than before. Speaking to each other through the chain link fence, illustrating that there is in fact a divide between inmate and supervisor, Omar admits that he knows that he fucked up again, and that bullshit aside, he wants to own his own mind. McManus admits that even he isn't sure why he thinks he can help Omar, but tells Omar again that he isn't giving up on him. Omar thanking McManus as he then puts his fingers to Omar's in the fence in a sort of mini showing of unity. I was sure that we'd had McManus tell Omar in the past that he wasn't going to give up on him, but perhaps I've misremembered that and was thinking of this particular moment. That is the end of Omar's involvement for this episode though, as we see a flashback of Beecher, back when he used to have to wear glasses to see, something which he seems to have cured himself of when he smashed them on the floor, meeting with Mrs. Rockwell from back in Series 1, Episode 6, To Your Health. You'll recall, and as we see here, that that meeting didn't go very well. Mrs. Rockwell smacking the viewing glass and telling Beecher that she not only hopes that he dies in Oz, but that he rots in hell too. The flashback ending on an echo of Mrs. Rockwell's cry of, "You killed my baby!" Back in the present day, Beecher is in Pete's office with her and Catherine as they're discussing Beecher's upcoming parole hearing, which is set for the following Wednesday. Catherine says that according to Hoyle, who I assume is another lawyer or legal rep of some type, that if all goes well, Beecher could be out of Oz by the end of the month. Beecher asks if the Rockwells have been made aware of the hearing, which as we've discussed previously, and as Catherine mentions here, isn't a legal requirement. But Beecher wants them to be told about his hearing, feeling that it's the right thing to do. Catherine, however, tells him that that isn't advisable, feeling that if asked to testify, the Rockwells may be able to sway the parole board away from granting Beecher his release. But Beecher explains that until Gary was killed, he'd never fully understood what he'd done to the Rockwells, and that he can't go back into the world knowing that he, at least in his mind, has snuck out, and that the Rockwells are as much a part of his prison term as anyone else and have a right to be heard. I can see where Catherine is coming from. She wants to do everything possible to make sure that Beecher gets a favourable result in his hearing. But Beecher at the end of the day, and despite some questionable actions throughout his time on the show, is still meant to be the show's central hero. We came into the show with him, the entire first episode was more or less focused entirely on him, he is our lead character, and we are meant to root for him. He has done some very questionable things along the way since the show started to where we're at now, but how much of that is down to his surroundings and the need to survive? Would Beecher have done the things that he has had he been in a medium security prison rather than one as intense or as dangerous as Oz? Pete says that she'll get in touch with the Rockwells. She doesn't make any promises, but she respects Beecher's wish. But she also wants Beecher and the Rockwells to have a victim-offender interaction prior to the parole hearing. Beecher doesn't seem against the idea and says to Catherine that he hopes that she understands why he's doing this. Catherine admits that as his lawyer she thinks he's insane, but as a mother she thinks he has balls for days, as she takes Beecher's hand. Cut to the visiting room where for only the second time on the show as Mrs. Rockwell is Catherine Maisel, meaning that entry to the Oz One and Done Club is no longer available to her, while making his debut in the role of Mr. Dave Rockwell is Alex Webb. Making his screen acting debut in 1989 in the TV movie Coded Hostile, Alex also had recurring roles on TV, appearing as Ivan on In Our Lives between 1989 and 1994, while between 1996 and 1998 he appeared as Glenn Nellis in Homicide: Life on the Street, appearing in episodes written by Tom Fontana and appearing with a number of Oz alumni. In 2000, Alex would make his film debut, appearing in a minor role in the movie Boiler Room, before appearing here on Oz. Having put in the call, Pete sits down with Beecher and the Rockwells to discuss where things have gone since they were last face to face.
Last time we saw each other, Mrs. Rockwell, I didn't say much.
You didn't say anything?
Yeah. Well, that's because I was on drugs. I was confused, full of self-loathing.
And now you've forgiven yourself?
No. What I did to your daughter will shadow me forever. Just as being in Oz will. What's happened to me in here... well, whether I've suffered enough to satisfy you, I don't know.
When you were sentenced to 15 years, I was stunned. 15 lousy years doesn't equal the lifetime my daughter lost. You say you've suffered. And I say I'm glad.
When the lawyer came to talk about my being paroled, she said that because of extenuating circumstances, the board might look kindly on me.
Why don't you explain the circumstances?
Since I've been inside, my son was murdered, and my wife may have been, both as a result of things I did in here. It's ironic that I came to Oz walking across the grave of your daughter, and I may leave walking across the graves of my own family. If they had lived, I wouldn't have the chance of going free.
When I saw you 4 years ago, the pain of Kathy's death was still so new. David and I grieved and grieved and grieved. We still do. But the sorrow is balanced with joy. We have another child, Richard, and he's growing up to be remarkable. We've come to believe that even though we don't understand why Kathy's gone, we accept her death as part of some wise plan. I don't know if you've suffered enough. That's not up to me to decide. Only God can. We will not interfere with your parole.
I wanted to include that whole clip there, as in a lot of ways it's reflective on the characters that there is a lot to take in with the amount that has occurred since they last met. We didn't even meet Dave last time, so to the best of our knowledge, this is Beecher's first chance to lay things out for him. But there's so much more to draw on that's occurred since that last meeting, such as Beecher's drug addiction, the death of Gary and possible murder of Genevieve, which still has an air of ambiguity that I quite like. While as it relates to the Rockwells, they've had to try and make sense of it all whilst also bringing another life into the world, a son named Richard. When questioned about forgiving him, Beecher doesn't try to make out that he has forgiven himself, nor does he seek forgiveness from them. All he wants from this and from them is some understanding. He doesn't try to make out as though leaving Oz will be the end of what has happened. He knows that Kathy's death will be with him till the day he dies, excellently put as her shadowing him forever. But he makes it known that his release will provide them all with the opportunity to move on. Dave doesn't hide his anger at what he sees as a bogus sentence and says that he's glad that Beecher has suffered. But it's different for Mrs. Rockwell. I have to keep calling her Mrs. Rockwell because we never actually find out her first name. She admits that the pain of Kathy's death was still new at the previous meeting, so it's understandable as to why she was full of anger, whereas this time she is more mentally prepared. She and Dave have had the time to compartmentalize their grief, something which she says they still do, but that they are now in a place where the sorrow is balanced due to the joy they have with their new son, and that while they may not understand why Kathy is gone, they have accepted that her death may be part of God's wise plan, which I'm not sure I buy, but I digress, and that it isn't up to her to decide if Beecher has suffered enough, but that they are now in a place where they are prepared to move on, and that Beecher should be provided that right also. Her admitting that they won't interfere with Beecher's parole, despite perhaps having the right to do so, puts them as equals with Beecher. He wanted to do right by them by allowing them to be informed of his possible release, while they're doing right by him by letting the judicial process take its course. We get an Augustus vignette quoting Vince Lombardi, former head coach of the Green Bay Packers, who once said that winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. Bit of a discrepancy with that quote, as although Lombardi is known to have used it on the opening day of a Packers training camp back in 1959, it can be attributed to as far back as the 1930s when Henry Russell was the coach of the UCLA Bruins. A variation of the quote can also be traced back to 1950 when it was used by Red Sanders during a physical education workshop at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, as well as a 1953 article in the Los Angeles Herald and Express written by Bud Ferrillo, both of which predate Lombardi's use of the phrase. Lombardi himself claimed on occasion that he was misquoted, with his intention being to say, "Winning isn't everything, the will to win is the only thing." However, there are a number of other examples of him using the original quote. Augustus continues, claiming that the one thing that Lombardi held in higher regard than winning was character, saying that without character there would be no victory. Now don't get Augustus wrong, he mentions about how Lombardi's players would sometimes miss a curfew or generally fool around, as sportsmen tend to do, but they always knew where to draw the line, finishing by saying that a good man knows where to do so, as he smacks the football that he's holding against his other hand. We've spoken before about legal clearances and copyrights and all that kind of thing, and if you look at the football that Augustus is holding here, it is most definitely a ball manufactured by the Wilson Sporting Goods Company. Clearly though, the show didn't get the proper permission to use Wilson's name or their logo on screen. So how did they get around this? Rather than use a different brand of football and go through the process of paying someone else for use of their logo, or just simply turn the football around so as to not show the logo in the first place, someone was handed the task of scratching the W off of Wilson to make it into a V, meaning that the show hasn't paid anyone anything other than maybe $20 to the local sporting goods store. We see Officer Smith making his rounds in Solitary, where the show turns into 1987's Predator for a moment as Clayton channels Arnold Schwarzenegger by calling Robson one ugly motherfucker. Robson gets in a dig of his own, saying about how he doesn't see Clayton modelling in Milan. A possible reference to the absent Adebisi there? Adewale was a Milan fashion model prior to his acting career, but it could just as likely be a coincidence and not a reference to anything. All of his cat scratching is getting on the nerves of Miguel, who is trying to have a wank in his cell, and with a line that has clearly been ADR'd in post-production. We're the better part of 40 episodes deep into the show now, so I think it's safe to say that we've gotten used to how things are meant to look with the show, but the same can be said for how things sound. I talked a while back, I think it was back in Series 2, about sound effects and sound design with how shower water was used. But by this point we've gotten used to the acoustics of scenes with how it pertains to spoken dialogue. That's not to say things have never been touched up in post-production before, I'd guarantee that something somewhere has been sweetened in some way, but it's so audibly noticeable here. Just listen to these two lines from Miguel, the first where he's telling everyone to shut up, and the second where he's shouting to Leo, and the difference in his tone to that of everyone else.
Robson, you are one ugly motherfucker.
I don't see you modeling in Milan. You black bitch.
Hey, shut the fuck up. I'm trying to masturbate.
Fuck you, Alvarez.
Quiet. Warden's on deck.
Yo, Glenn. Yo, I need an appointment.
Hey, Glenn,
motherfucker.
You get me excited. Why don't you hold my dick?
So as Smith just mentioned there, Leo has come down to Solitary to meet with Clayton, who's asked to speak with Leo alone. Leo isn't taking any chances, checking that Smith has frisked Clayton for weapons, but Smith says that he's clean and leaves the cell. Clayton seems put out by having been searched, asking Leo if he really thinks that he'd shank him, but Leo tells him that he has no idea what Clayton is capable of anymore. Clayton sarcastically says that he's stunned, making out that Leo, a man supposedly feared by all the inmates at Oz, is actually the one afraid of him. Not falling into Clayton's trap, Leo asks him what he wants, as Clayton tells him that he's decided to confess to Johnny's murder, and that he intends to ask for the death penalty, Leo seeing right through Clayton's plan and accusing him of wanting to die a martyr. Clayton is taking this very seriously though, producing a handwritten manifesto that he wants to be published on the day that he's executed. Leo is furious that Clayton has somehow got his hands on some paper, and he calls Smith back and tells him that under no circumstances is Clayton to be given any more in the future, and says that if Clayton wants to destroy himself, that's fine, but he isn't going to make it easy for him. What comes next is one of the most impressive displays the show has ever seen, as it all occurs in the space of about 2 square feet. Clayton lunges towards Leo, calling him a goddamn motherfucker. Reacting with the speed only previously seen when encountering lightning, Smith shoulder charges Leo with the force of an NFL linebacker, sending him flying across the cell onto the bed in the corner. The scene closes with Clayton laughing maniacally and holding his ribs, presumably due to being hit harder than he's ever been hit in his life, as he calls Leo Uncle Tom and tells him, "Don't leave me like this," as Leo does in fact go to leave. The term Uncle Tom is something that I've only ever heard referenced elsewhere, but it's a reference to Harriet Beecher Stowe's 1852 novel Uncle Tom's Cabin, and has become a term used to negatively describe black people who participate in the oppression of fellow black people, or who are seen as being excessively subservient to white people. Before Leo leaves, however, we pivot into Robson's story, as he tells Leo that he has no case against him now that Carl Jenkins is dead, and that he wants out of solitary, and to get him a lawyer, specifically saying that he wants Saeed, and proceeds to bark like a dog and gnash his teeth. Interesting how Robson actually comes across as the type of psychotic that you can buy into, whereas Clayton just comes across as someone who's gone down that conspiracy theory rabbit hole. Cut to the dark corridor where Leo has met up with Saeed, telling him that he doesn't want Robson released from solitary any more than Saeed does, but that he doesn't have a choice due to Jenkins' suicide, and that while a good defense attorney could shoot holes through Jenkins' testimony, without it they don't have a case against Robson. Unfortunately for Saeed, who mentions that even though Robson masterminded the death of Salah, formerly known as Leroy, and has sworn to kill Saeed too, Leo has no option but to place Robson back in Genpop, Leo pointing out that keeping Robson in solitary when they can't prove his guilt would be unjust, Saeed asking him why does justice only work in someone else's favour. It's a fair point from Saeed, Robson has made it clear that he wants Saeed dead and Leo knows that, but at the same time Saeed has been clamouring all this time for a fair justice system, something which ultimately involves due process. It's unfortunate that he is the one who is caught in the firing line with all of this, but if the shoe were on the other foot, he'd be the first one to pipe up saying that Leo needs the evidence to proceed with a trial to eventually lead to a conviction. Yeah, it fucking sucks that Robson is going to get away with this with no repercussions for Salah's death, but you can't have it both ways. You can't cry foul for one person and do everything by the book with the evidence intact, nor can you seek a conviction with nothing to support your claim. Following this setback, Saeed heads to the library where he is confiding in Arif, saying that he has such rage inside of him, a rage unlike one he's ever known, which considering that he was convicted of second-degree arson, that is quite a rage. Arif says that Saeed has always been able to control these kind of emotions previously, but Saeed is beginning to feel as though he won't be able to do so this time, and he even says that he feels as if he is possessed. And his movements here are very unlike the Saeed we've seen before. He isn't what I'd call full-on shaking, but there is definitely some kind of a tremble there. Trying to settle his imam's fears, Arif tells him to pray to Allah, but Saeed is angered by that, saying that he prays and he gets nothing in return as he looks to the heavens as if to say, "You hear me? Why aren't you answering me?" as Robson and Schillinger enter the library. Not missing his chance to stir some shit up, Robson tells Saeed that he's sorry about what happened to Leroy, or Ooga Booga, or whatever the fuck Saeed was calling him. Classy as always, that Robson. Not surprisingly, this display of racist bullshit unleashes Saeed's previously mentioned rage, as he grabs Robson around the shirt collar and forces him back against the bookshelf. And the look of terror in Robson's eyes here is incredible. He instantly regrets his decision to wind Saeed up here, as Saeed punches him repeatedly in the face. Arif gets in on the action too, taking a shot at Schillinger, who is knocked out cold as an enraged Saeed continues to lay the smackdown on Robson. In a move that doesn't help his cause and only serves to make matters even worse, Robson calls Saeed the N-word, which only leads to Saeed punching him even harder, asking Robson if he truly wants to see the N-word in him. Arif holds back the other Muslims to allow the beatdown to continue, as a CO can't open the library door due to Schillinger's unconscious body wedging the door closed, only allowing for Saeed to continue to deliver the punishment. In this scene, I counted a total of 12 individual punches from Saeed to Robson, topped off by 2 axe handle smashes, as we then see Saeed being thrown into the hole, as well as Robson spouting more racist nonsense as he's attended to in the hospital. Some tremendous makeup on R.E. Rogers here. His face is lumpy and bumpy and bruised to high heaven. Great way of putting across the beating he's received. But I also love the shot where Saeed gets a splash of Robson's blood on his teeth. To get blood to spray that far upwards, that's a hell of a shot that he'll have hit on Robson to do that. So that elevates this beating even more and also provides a great visual of Saeed looking like a savage animal, emphasising that rage he was talking about to Arif. We get an excellent montage of Arif in M-City rallying the Muslim troops, telling them that the Aryans must be stopped and that they'll no longer tolerate their actions, as well as Schillinger gathering his forces over in Unit B, acknowledging that with Saeed in the hole, Arif is now in charge, and also mentioning that they need to watch each other's backs as the Muslims are now pissed off more than ever, and to carry weapons wherever they can. Bit of a missed opportunity to have a callback to the debut episode here by telling them to wear armour rather than carry weapons. You'll recall, of course, the initial meeting between Beecher and Schillinger saw Schillinger tell Beecher to wear armour and lift his shirt up to show him wearing the phone book. A minor thing, I know, but the show is usually so good at that sort of thing. But that opportunity seemed to go begging here. Cut to Schillinger meeting with Cloutier in Ray's office, which Cloutier says is being loaned to him, which is a nice way to cover for one of Ray's, or more specifically BD Wong's, prolonged absences from the show. In addition to working on Oz, BD had joined the cast of Law & Order Special Victims Unit during the show's second season, although his debut wouldn't air until May of 2001. Much like Chris Maloney and a few other cast members, BD was working on Oz and SVU simultaneously. However, BD was also filming around this time for the movie The Salt and Sea, which was released the following year. Juggling Oz and SVU would have been demanding enough, but was possible due to both shows' filming locations being in such close proximity. However, The Salt and Sea filmed in California over 2,500 miles away, so BD was unavailable for much of the second half of Series 4. In fact, it only really dawned on me here how little Ray has been in Series 4B. We saw him in Series 4 Episode 13, Blizzard of 01, an episode whose title I'm fairly sure I'll never forget ever again, but his only other appearance so far in Series 4B was in Episode 12, Cuts Like a Knife. We will see him again before the end of the series, but Ray is absent for more than half of this block of Series 4. Anyway, Cloutier has been asked by Leo to speak with Schillinger, Leo fearing there may be an escalation of hostilities between the Aryans and the Muslims following Saeed's recent battering of Robson. Cloutier asks for Schillinger to sit, but Schillinger cuts an intimidating stance with his hands on his hips, explaining that the hacks have a good reason to fear, and he even dehumanises Cloutier somewhat by referring to him as Preacher, saying that Cloutier has reason to fear him too. Cloutier tries to make sense of things, asking if Schillinger feels as though he has wronged him by getting Carl Jenkins to testify against Robson for Leroy's murder, but he assures Schillinger that he did so in the name of justice, a concept that Schillinger supposedly holds dear. Schillinger calls Cloutier on his motives, saying that he did it because Robson got pissed about Cloutier trying to turn him into a psalm singer. Cloutier almost laughs at that notion, saying that he never imagined that Schillinger would actually convert, and that he simply wanted Schillinger to experience a little bit of joy in his life, specifically the birth of his grandchild. That brings us nicely back around to the story from the previous episode about Baby Jewel's place in the Schillinger family bloodline, Schillinger asking if Cloutier spoke to that woman in his congregation. Schillinger calling her that woman, Cloutier reminding him that she's named Sarah, could be another example of Schillinger being laser beam focused on his own issues right now. Or he could have simply forgot. It's tough to decide exactly which side of the fence that has fallen. But Cloutier mentions that Sarah and Carrie have had a number of conversations, but at no time did Carrie ever mention about being a prostitute. Schillinger asks if Sarah asked Carrie directly, not sure how she would have worked that into the conversation exactly, but Cloutier tells him no, Schillinger says that nothing has been proved either way. Lucky, Schillinger is due to have a visit with Carrie in the next hour, so he'll have the chance to ask her himself. Unless, as Cloutier points out, Leo puts Oz into lockdown, as he gets Schillinger to assure him, for the time being at least, that there won't be any further hostilities. While the pivot from the Aryan Muslim hostilities part of the story into the baby Jewel part of the story may have been a little clunky, on the whole, this was another great little scene between JK and Luke Perry. They are probably the most consistent actors on the show right now. Cut to the visiting room where Carrie is changing baby Jewel when Schillinger arrives. Rather than tiptoe around the subject, and even refusing to hold Jewel, Schillinger immediately seeks an answer to his questions.
Hi, Mr. Schillinger. What happened to your face?
Nothing, it's fine.
There we are, all nice and dry. Hey, ready to play with Grandpa?
That's okay.
Something wrong?
I'm gonna ask you some serious questions. I want you to talk true.
Okay.
Put the baby down.
It's okay. It's okay, Jewel. Sweet.
It's come to my attention that you work the streets, hooking. Now I can see it's true.
Hank said we need
I don't want to hear that part. What's important is, whose child is that? She's not Hank's, is she? You knew that the day you showed up
Mr.
here.
Mr. Schillinger, I swear. When the doctor told me I was pregnant, I counted backwards, trying to figure out who the father was. On the day the baby was conceived, I had sex with three different men, okay? Two out-of-town salesmen and Hank. So the truth is, I don't know which one was the father. I'm not sure. Except, stare at her face. Don't she look like Hank? Don't she?
JK is absolutely brilliant again here, both in how he says things, but also with what he doesn't. When the penny drops that Carrie has known all along that Jewel might not be his granddaughter, his voice is raised, but he isn't shouting the place to the ground. Raised but forceful is probably the best way to describe it. I love how standoffish he is throughout the whole thing too. Whereas before he couldn't wait to hold baby Jewel, now he's closed himself off with his arms folded. His guard is up and barriers are in place now. Awesome stuff here from JK. We go back to the hall where McManus has gone to meet with Saeed, telling him that Cloutier's gotten Schillinger to agree to not retaliate and to keep Robson in check, and that he needs Saeed to offer the same assurances from the Muslims. Saeed, however, tells him no, McManus asking if that means no, you won't cooperate, but Saeed is meaning no, I can't assure you. And he means of anything, let alone the good behaviour of what Saeed calls his people or himself. He mentions that what's been going on has been going on for some time and will continue to go on long after the two of them and Schillinger are dead, elevating the whole thing to a level that McManus isn't currently concerned about. An idea that Saeed doesn't seem surprised at, accusing McManus of always taking the short view. McManus isn't standing for being lectured by a naked man hunkered in the corner of a room, however, and says that maybe Saeed could do with a couple more days in the hole and exits the scene. Saeed telling him to get out before taking a swipe at the wall, the sickening crunch and his painful recoil indicating that he's likely broken his hand, as Augustus waxes lyrical about athletes managing to control their tempers to close out Act 1.
Okay. Cloutier's gotten Schillinger to agree not to retaliate, so he's going to keep his boy Robson in check. I need your assurance that the Muslims will cooperate.
No.
No, no what? You won't cooperate?
No, I can't assure you of anything, McManus. Least of all, a good behavior, my people. Or myself. Because you see, what's been going on has been going on and will go on till long after you, me, and Schillinger are all dead.
My only concern is right now.
Yeah, well, that's not surprising because you always did take the short view.
Maybe you need another couple days in here.
Yeah, maybe I do.
You.
Go ahead. Get out!
Oh!
If athletes learn to control their tempers, to control their rage, then hockey players wouldn't do time in the penalty box. Basketball players wouldn't draw technical fouls. Football players wouldn't be penalized 15 yards. Of course, if athletes did control their rage, nobody be interested in sports. The punching, choking, kicking, biting, screaming, that's what the fans go to see.
So Act 2 gets going with McManus working on his shot for the upcoming Game 2 of the Best of 3 series, but he doesn't seem to have sorted his airball problem that plagued his game last time around. He meets up with Dave in the locker room, who drops in that McManus is training at 7 a.m. when the game isn't until the afternoon. You can't say that McManus isn't at the very least taking this whole thing seriously, and he also mentions about being haunted by his airball shots from the last game. Good guy Dave tells McManus not to beat himself up, saying that he couldn't get much momentum going either, as the two then discuss the basketballing qualities of elite NBA caliber player Vayhew, Dave describing him as a stern bitch, as well as a strong, tough, talented player. That goes without saying, Dave, because he plays in the fucking NBA. You don't get to that level without having a certain amount of talent, for fuck's sake. McManus agrees with that assessment, and apparently that's the same assessment that McManus has made of Dave. Maybe not word for word, but it has been enough for McManus to call up a friend of his who just so happens to be a scout for the Sacramento Kings, who is coming to the game this afternoon to take a look at what Dave has to offer. This is another of those just-go-with-it moments for the show here. I'm not claiming to be any sort of sporting talent scout myself, but I'm fairly sure that if we use Blake Robbins' real-world age of 35 at the time of filming here, it's safe to say that an NBA career has passed Dave Brass by at this point in his life. I'd love to know too why the Sacramento Kings were chosen as the team for the scout to be from. Being set in New York State and with Madison Square Garden being just 1 mile down the road from 9th Avenue where the show was filmed, the most obvious team to use would have been the New York Knicks. Or being in the northeast of the country, you could have maybe gone with the New Jersey Nets, or to go a bit further afield, you've got the Philadelphia 76ers or the Boston Celtics. All of those teams of which play in the NBA's Atlantic Division. As Jackson Vayhew clearly plays for the Los Angeles Lakers, as we discussed before, perhaps having their local rivals involved was the reason for the Kings being chosen here. Now, I'll admit that my basketball knowledge is pretty fair weather at best. My brother was a big fan, but it never totally appealed to me. But I can remember the Chicago Bulls being the dominant force in the sport throughout the 90s. The Sacramento Kings, however, were never really a standout team. They were just always sort of there. But they were actually having a really good 2000-2001 season at the time. The Kings, the oldest franchise in the league, beginning life in 1923 as the Rochester Seagrams in Rochester, New York, hadn't won an NBA title since 1951 when they were the Rochester Royals, nor had they won a division title since 1979 when they were based in Kansas City. Relocating to Sacramento in 1985, the team didn't achieve much in the way of success, going close to 20 years without a winning season record. In 2001, though, they were in the midst of a season that saw them finish second in the Pacific Division and third in the Western Conference with a 55-27 winning record. The team would go on to defeat the Phoenix Suns 3-1 in the first round of the playoffs, before going 0-4 in the conference semifinals against, wouldn't you believe it, Rick Fox's LA Lakers. Over in the cafeteria, Tug gives props to Vayhew for his performance in the first game, as Poet brings over a second helping of lunch for Vayhew ahead of Game 2, as well as a Gatorade from his special stash, Vayhew seeming pretty pleased to have been given something other than whatever they put in those juice cartons. Poet puts Dave over, saying that he has some talent, which Vayhew does agree with, but he's confident that Game 2 will go exactly the same as Game 1, saying that it will stay close as long as he lets it. We pan across the CEOs Johnson and Robinson, who have been listening to Vayhew and the others gloating about their previous victory. Being a fan of the sport, Robinson says that Vayhew has a wide body and there's no real way to guard him, and that ultimately McManus and Dave have no chance of winning. As Vayhew gets up to leave, Gatorade in hand, Robinson senses an opportunity,
telling Verhue to bust the tray that is left at the table. Poet, being one of the kitchen staff and all, says, "Nah, mate, it's fine, I'll get it." But Robinson says that Verhue can do it himself. Verhue cockily tells Robinson, "Fuck that," and turns to leave, which is Robinson's opening to take a whack at Verhue's knee with his baton. The whole thing causes some minor commotion. Surprising, as usually, this sort of thing leads to a full-scale fight, especially when the staff are so clearly outnumbered. But Verhue is complaining of a broken knee, and he's taken off to the ward where McManus is asking the two COs about what happened. Johnson tells McManus that Verhue brought the situation on himself, which is technically accurate, but also a bit of a stretch, and that they did things by the book, as McManus heads in to check on Verhue, who's worried about having injured his anterior cruciate ligament, which would usually have a recovery time of between 6 and 12 months. But Gloria tells him that he just has some bad swelling, and to stay off it for a few days. Having heard Gloria say that, McManus says that they'll postpone the game until next week, Verhue sarcastically saying that it's because McManus cares about him. But McManus wants Verhue at his best, Verhue reckoning that McManus still thinks he can beat him. Verhue gets up off the bed and once again asks Gloria about having any damage, Gloria saying that he has none that she can see, as Verhue says that he'll see McManus in the gym, and to tell Dave to bring his A game. Why doesn't Gloria jump in here? She's literally just said that Verhue needs to stay off it for a few days. Fuck the machismo in the room, she should be there shouting, "I am a doctor! Listen to me!" So despite Gloria's medical assessment, we head over to the gym for Game 2 of the Best of 3 series as Verhue wraps his knee and McManus gives a nod to a man in the crowd, presumably McManus' talent scout friend. And surely this is a very dangerous idea to just have him mixing with these maximum security prison inmates? What could possibly go wrong? The game gets underway to the tune of Kid Rock's "I've Got One For Ya." That's the full extent as to how much I'm going to mention Kid Rock, because he's fucking shit and a complete bellend. But Game 2 goes very differently to Game 1, as we see McManus beating Verhue at the tip-off and making an easy basket. Despite hobbling around on his bad knee, Verhue is still able to make some shots, and even Boost Malez gets on the scoreboard once again, although his shot was not as glorious as it was in the previous game. Following an interesting transition, which I'm going to call the zigzag wipe, the score is indeed tight, with Verhue and Boost Malez actually ahead 37-34. See, even with a bum knee, Verhue is still able to keep this thing close because he's an elite NBA-level basketball player! He can't keep it going right to the end though, as McManus and Dave eventually win the game 58-46. McManus even sinking a sweet shot right at the buzzer, finally managing to get over those air balls. The staff are very pleased with the outcome, while the inmates chant bullshit, as we cut back to M-City where Verhue hobbles through the unit and is greeted with a number of unhappy faces, including Ryan pulling back on a high five to brush his hair back, the classic psych move, as Chucky says Verhue has let them down, while Morales gives out about having lost a lot of money on the game and calling Verhue a cocksucker. Seeking the solace of his homeboy friends, Verhue asks Tug to move his leg from the chair that he's resting it on, Verhue saying that he needs to elevate his leg. Tug eventually does give up the chair and Verhue places his leg on top of the table, which is the cue for Poet and Tug to leave. Before Poet leaves, Verhue asks if he can get some more Gatorade at dinner, but Poet kind of fobs him off, telling him, "Oh, I don't know, I'll see what I can do. That's going to be a tall order." Up in McManus' office, the King Scout is telling Dave that he wants him to come out to their rookie camp in 3 weeks' time. The guy playing the King's Scout here, I've got no idea what his name is, and he's not even credited in the end credits, which is odd considering that he has a speaking role, and even more so when we've had people who are literally standing in the background credited on the show before. This could just be someone who works on the show in a production capacity, simply given the role because they needed someone that day, but there's no way of actually being able to narrow down who this person is. I'm also questioning his credentials when it comes to being a scout. Aside from the previously mentioned Dave is 35 years old issue, when you're scouting a player, wouldn't you do it over a period of time rather than off the back of one game? An exhibition game at that? With this guy scouting, it's amazing that the Kings were doing as well as they were. Seemingly anyone that plays alright on any particular day has a shot of making the roster. Or maybe he's actually fucking amazing at his job and he's able to spot a talent that quickly and has actually managed to recruit a hell of a team at the Kings. Before he goes, he tells Dave that he doesn't want to discourage Dave playing any pickup games, He doesn't want to disrupt the series after all, but to use his head. With the scout having left, Dave tells McManus that he'll still play, but McManus doesn't want to ruin Dave's opportunity. After all, how many times is he going to get this opportunity at the age of 35? And he tells Dave that he'll find someone else for the deciding game. Dave leaves McManus' office, adorably pumping his fists in triumph as he leaves, as McManus tries to figure out what he's going to do for Game 3. As we go down to the laundry room where Morales is going through his dirties, McManus passes by with Murphy, McManus possibly looking to recruit him for the final game. Morales can't help but stir the pot though after hearing some rumours about Dave.
There he goes now, the luckiest man on the planet.
Lucky?
Correction. Formerly lucky. The word's out, McManus. That scout today came to scoop up your boy. He's on his way to the Kings.
Mm-hmm.
Without Braz, you're gonna look pretty fucking foolish. I bet you lose by 50, 60 points.
Well, who says I'm without him?
But Dave Braz wasn't playing.
He's not.
So what was that all about?
I couldn't stomach giving Morales the satisfaction. I'll get it soon enough.
I love the look from Murphy when McManus implies that Dave might still be playing, but I also liked how McManus now seems completely aware that it's Dave who has brought him this far in the series, and that without him, Vahew is likely to hand his arse to him, compounded by his admission that Morales will get his satisfaction soon enough. But at least something good can come of all of this now that Dave Braz is heading to rookie camp at the ripe old age of 35. A lot of fire in that youngster. Having had the wool pulled over his eyes by McManus bullshitting about Dave still playing, Morales is actually concerned about the outcome of the series now, having already lost a bunch of money on Game 2, and perhaps now feeling as though the same is going to happen in the decider. I mean, if he's so concerned about losing money, he could always, I don't know, not bet on it? Surely the easiest way to not lose money is to not put yourself into a potentially losing scenario? Either way, Morales heads to the gym to speak with Carlos Martinez, making his first appearance in Series 4, Episode 2, when he attempted to kill Miguel on the orders of El Cid and Chico. They make some small talk, Morales mentioning about Leo still having Carlos over in Unit B, where we know from previous episodes inmates can simply vanish into for an extended period of time, before asking Carlos for a favour, whispering something into his ear. But we clearly hear him mention Dave's name, as we cut to Unit B where we see Carlos carrying a shank in his right hand. The con is on as he bumps into another inmate, walking through the unit with all the grace of a robot that shit itself, as their ensuing shoving match draws the attention of Dave, who leaps in to save the day, but winds up on the floor with a robotic inmate. With Carlos still having a vertical base, he grabs Dave's foot and slices his Achilles tendon with a shank, a horrified, pained expression adorning Dave's face, as the shank is then passed off from Carlos to another inmate, who passes it off to someone else and so on a few more times, with the weapon disappearing into the ether, never to be found. McManus heads down to the ward where Dave has been taken with his injury, Gloria giving him the bad news about Dave's fledgling basketball career. She explains that Dave needs surgery, due to his Achilles tendon not having just been severed, but actually missing a chunk, and that Dave is done with basketball and will likely be walking funny for the rest of his life. Everything that Gloria says here, from what I can gather, is fairly accurate. Most often surgery is required when dealing with an Achilles tendon injury, although not in every case depending on its severity. With surgery, a high-level athlete can usually return to action within 6 months to a year, although there is often the chance of the tendon re-tearing. In Dave's case, however, seeing as he has a chunk of his tendon missing, that is indeed him done, as we see a shot of him making a dunk, a glory that he'll never experience again, as we close out Act 2 with what I'm calling the ping pong ball dissolve. Seriously, some of the transitions and dissolve used at this point in the show are fucking horrible.
Hey, Martinez.
Hey. Hola, mi hermano.
Hey, the warden still got you over in Unit B?
Yeah.
Excellent. I need an ask.
Ask?
It's a deep hole of glass.
He's just left. He needed surgery.
Fuck. How bad was he?
On the big scale of things, he's gonna be just fine.
But?
But Dave's done with basketball. His Achilles tendon wasn't just severed, a chunk of it was missing. He'll be walking funny the rest of his life.
Act 3 then gets underway with Tug making his way over to Augustus in the cafeteria, and he's still giving Augustus shit for snitching on Bear and foiling their plans to whack Morales, Chucky, and whoever else was on their hit list as they attempted to take control of the drug trade. Augustus goes to leave. He's had to put up with this for a number of weeks now, but Tug brings him back saying that Bear says that Augustus gets to live, due to their history, but he warns Augustus that Bear isn't going to be around forever, and that when he dies, Augustus dies too. Having offered an olive branch previously, Supreme heads over to aid Augustus, telling Tug to let him go, and they square up to each other, but Officer Robinson is in fairly quickly to stop things from escalating, even saying that as much as he'd like to see them whack each other, the smart thing to do would be to walk away, which Tug does, telling Supreme that he'll see him later. Pity this didn't get to go down, as I think this is as close as we've come so far on the show to some real-world hip-hop beef, with Wu-Tang taking on Brand Nubian right here. It's also the latest in a number of scraps this episode which have been diffused fairly quickly. The staff seem to really be on it this week. Supreme turns his attention to Augustus and reaffirms his offer of friendship from the last episode, telling Augustus that he has no friends left other than him, which brings a concerned look to Augustus' face, almost as if it's only just dawned on him that what Supreme has told him is true. And from a certain point of view, it is. He's still got those in the others to watch his back, and to a lesser extent, Ryan and the Irish. I wouldn't say he and Ryan are exactly best friends, but they don't have any problem with each other either. But with the exception of a few within those groups, you've also got some of Oz's elder population, who aren't going to be a match for the much younger crew that Bear has at his disposal. Cut to the library where, true to his word, Tug does see Supreme later on. He sits down with his back to Supreme as they begin to talk.
The plan's working.
Yeah. Morales and Pacamo think I'm their slave.
Burratton thinks I'm his most loyal soldier.
When we're done, they'll all be dead. We'll be running things our way. But I have to admit, Tug, I was kind of surprised when you tapped my shoulder. Me being the one that greased your brother and all.
When I shanked you, and you didn't die, I knew you had balls.
I loved how you had Tug and Supreme having this little meeting, sitting at different tables with their backs to each other. Meeting but not meeting. That was a really good touch. Someone who sees right through this, though, despite having arrived partway through the conversation, is Edward, who does that pretend to be looking for a book but I'm actually eavesdropping thing, which anyone else would have probably noticed straight away. But Tug and Supreme aren't necessarily the sharpest of knives, so they fail to notice him. Back in M-City, Edward tells Bear that it doesn't take a genius to see that Tug is a traitor. While Bear does admit to having had his own suspicions about Tug's loyalty, he does take what Edward tells him to be true. I've seen some criticism towards Bear simply taking Edward's word for this, but I haven't got a problem with it. While they may still be relatively new to each other's company, Edward doesn't have any motive or reason to lie to Bear, nor does he have any solid affiliation to anyone else. So what would he have to gain from lying about Tug? Asking what Bear plans to do about things, Bear tells Edward that he believes every man deserves a fair trial. Before he's executed, of course, as we cut to the gym where an already beat up Tug is sat in a chair with his hands tied behind him, as Poet pays off a CO so that the homeboys can conduct their court proceedings. Bear, the presiding judge of course, gets told fuck you by Tug, as Poet, presumably in the role of the prosecution, tells him that he's been accused of the three disses, disloyal, dishonest, and disrespectful, as Bear asks how Tug pleads. Rather than enter a plea, Tug tells them if they're going to take him out to just get it over with, as Poet presents his evidence that Tug has been seen fraternising with Supreme. Tug's defence? I was just letting Supreme think I was with him, the old double bluff, and that as soon as he killed Bear, he was going to kill Supreme and Augustus. I hadn't clicked that Tug was implying earlier that he was going to kill Bear. I just took it as him thinking that Bear was an old man who would likely die soon anyway, but now it makes sense. With that admission, Poet rests his case as Bear asks if Tug has any defence.
Tug saying that his defense is that Bear is a hypocrite for killing him for the same crime that he let Augustus walk on, which is either a great turn of phrase or in very poor taste. It depends which side of the fence you want to sit on. Sealing his fate, Tug says that Bear is getting older and going soft, and that he can't go the distance anymore, which causes Bear to call for silence. Tug continues to rant, saying that with him in charge, the homeboys would be running Oz, as Bear puts his hand on Tug's shoulders and gets right in his face and commands him to listen. He tells Tug that it is the decision of the court that he has been found guilty, who would have guessed that considering the obviously fair nature in which proceedings have been conducted, and that he sentences Tug to death, grabbing Tug around the throat and choking him. The way in which Bear kills Tug here is quite intense and against what Tug was just saying about Bear going soft, as he chokes Tug using only one hand, illustrating that Bear still has incredible strength despite his advancing years. Bear wipes his hand using a handkerchief, literally wiping his hands of Tug, and tells his crew to throw Tug behind the back of the cafeteria in one of the garbage dumpsters, Bear giving Tug the send-off that he obviously feels that he deserves. He also seems to turn into the Wicked Witch of the West for a moment when telling his crew to get a move on.
Throw his ass back there behind the cafeteria. Stick him in a garbage dumpster.
Move it!
At lunch, we see Ryan throwing a bag of garbage into the dumpster as he then spots something peculiar among the rubbish. The thing in question is Tug's hand, as he then uncovers his body underneath some other bags, Ryan having discovered his second dead body this series. He calls for Officer Robinson, who I think has had more screen time this episode than he has the entire show so far, who calls in a code 44, which according to APCO codes would be for a riot, which is obviously not the case. A report of death would be a code 67. He does call for a lockdown though, which you would do for either of those situations, so I'll let him off on that one. Ryan informs Supreme of Tug's death, who in turn tells Augustus that their days are numbered, and that if they're not careful, they'll end up the same way. The cafeteria is evacuated as Supreme and Bear pass each other, and we get another interesting transition from Tug's dead corpse to Augustus monologuing about how more and more these days you can pick up a newspaper and it's some athlete with their name in the headlines, and not necessarily in the sports pages. Augustus admits that he's never surprised, saying that the adrenaline it takes to be a superstar is the same as what you experience when committing a crime, and that it's hard to put a cap on that when the game's over and it's time to go back to being ordinary. I did try and find if the headline in Augustus' newspaper here, Gonzaga Ohio State Move Up, was from a real newspaper or not. It doesn't seem to be real, it is most likely a prop made for the episode, but in what could be another example of let's see if we can get away with this and hope that no one finds out, the newspaper does look as though it's a copy of USA Today, specifically USA Today Sports, which, I don't know, does the US have separate papers for sports compared to the regular news or not? Here in the UK, the sports pages are usually at the back of the newspaper, whereas the banner headline here looks to be on the front. I don't know, it could be real, but I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't. But having someone quickly nip down to the newsstand down the street would be very on brand with the show. There's also an American football game playing on a TV to Augustus' side, and I'm not even going to try and work out who's playing in that one. One of the teams seems to be in green and white, which would suggest that it's the New York Jets. But I doubt that Tom Fontana would allow any other team other than his beloved Buffalo Bills to be on his show. Cut to Leo's office where he is having a meeting with Sister Pete when Devlin, who we last saw hobbling on his crutches at the convention held at Oz, arrives having a moan about how he's sick of hearing about Death Row. Sister Pete, through a thin veil of sarcasm, mentions about Devlin being fully recovered, and he fires back that he can see how much that pleases her. We've never really had an exploration of the relationship between Pete and Devlin. Her firm anti-Death Row stance is probably enough to separate them into their respective roles, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's more instances of conflict if there was a more fleshed out history between the two of them. Not wishing to make things last longer than he absolutely has to, Devlin gets down to business saying that after extensive talks with the Attorney General, a role which in the real world had recently been appointed to Senator John Ashcroft, according to the law, Giles is in fact within his rights to be asked to be stoned to death, and that the anti-death penalty group that's currently suing, which I wouldn't be surprised if Pete is directly involved with, will most likely win. But he mentions that the state will appeal, meaning that the case will eventually transfer to the state Supreme Court. While that might be a better prospect for Devlin's stance in the long run, he admits that it's not a given, and that God knows what those buttheads will decide. Pete saying that Devlin appointed half of said court. She is on fire with the sarcasm this episode. rather than drag things out further, the state has come to the conclusion that it'll be simpler if Pete declares Giles to be mentally incompetent, allowing for Devlin to commute Giles' death sentence to a life sentence, which in turn allows for them to ship Giles off to the Connolly Institute, mirroring the ongoing situation that already exists with Cyril, where Devlin says Giles can blubber until he dies. Giles having his sentence commuted would also afford Devlin the opportunity to have the legislation rewritten to limit the options of death to either lethal injection or electrocution. New York State having previously carried out electric chair executions between August 6, 1890, the very first in the world of its kind with the execution of William Kemmler, and August 15, 1963, when Eddie Lee Mays became the final person executed in the state. Unsurprisingly, Pete isn't willing to go along with this idea, declaring that Giles is not insane, as Devlin looks to Leo for some assistance, who does say to Pete that if she does this, then the problem will go away, which is not the word to be using, as Pete tells them both that the problem won't go away until the death penalty goes away, and that every other week, and through advancements in DNA evidence, more and more horror stories of innocent men almost being put to death are coming to light. She mentions about the governor of Illinois, George Ryan at this point in time, putting a moratorium on executions, which is Devlin's breaking point as he calls George Ryan an arsehole. We touch on George Ryan briefly in a previous episode, and his contributions to the capital punishment debate due to this moratorium mentioned here, as well as commuting a number of death row inmate sentences in 2003, which of course in terms of where we are in the show's timeline is yet to occur. Chances are that Pete's opinion of Mr. Ryan may well have changed a couple of years later when Mr. Ryan's political career was marred in a scandal following Operation Safe Road, a corruption investigation into the sale of government contracts, leases and licenses stemming from his time as Secretary of State. Following a lengthy trial, prisoner number 03R242 George Ryan was convicted on September 6, 2003 on charges of federal racketeering, bribery, extortion, money laundering and tax fraud, and was sentenced to 6.5 years. It's kind of ironic that all of this came out after the show has finished, as with a laundry list of bad shit like that, George Ryan sounds like someone that Devlin would have been quite fond of. Not getting anywhere with Pete or Leo, saying that if he wanted a debate he'd go on TV's Meet the Press, Devlin says there are plenty of shrinks in town, and that if Pete won't declare Giles insane then he'll find someone who will, which ideally would have been the perfect moment for Dr. Nick Riviera to enter the room, and he storms out as we cut to Pete heading down to death row to meet with Giles. Pete asks how Giles is doing as he references Moses being dead and that he's lonely, Giles now being the sole resident of the death row unit. Pete says that it's lonely out there too, and how Giles and others' lives being in the hands of lawyers and politicians leaves her feeling powerless. Giles, rather cutely, raises a clenched fist and calls Pete a noisemaker, which gets a laugh out of her and is actually quite a sweet moment between the two of them. Giles approaches the bars saying us, and as only he can, asks for the two of them to pray. Pete takes his hand and repeats back to him about what they have, and she also caresses his cheek. And I swear, just for a moment there, it looked like they were about to start making out. But thankfully, that doesn't happen, as that would have been a twist too far even by the mad standards we've seen before on the show. A quick news report in M-City tells us that the state Supreme Court, by a vote of 5-4, so literally as close as it could have been, have declared the capital punishment law to be unconstitutional based on Giles' case, and that allowing such an execution to take place would be cruel and unusual punishment, as the inmates cheer the decision. Not far away from these joyous scenes, Devlin is being questioned by the press about what happens now. He tells the assembled mass that his support for the death penalty is unwavering. However, the reaction of the public has shown that they need to use this opportunity to take a step back and consider not only how the state determines a sentence, but also the way in which it's implemented. Devlin is in full politician mode as he tells the press about a new non-partisan committee that is being created to look at the death penalty and all of its aspects, as a semi-smiling, semi-smirking smug Pete exits from the background. With his death sentence now on the back burner, Giles is brought back to solitary. Clayton seems confused to see him, saying that he thought Giles was halfway to death, but Giles declares himself very much alive as he's placed in his cell. His joy quickly turns to sadness, however, because any moment of joy in Oz has to be counteracted with a hefty dose of grim soon afterwards, as his smile disappears as he takes a look around the tight confines of his solitary cell, The realization setting in that he's right back where he was when he was first introduced back in Series 2, as he questions being alive as we close out Act 3.
The state Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, declared the 4-year-old capital punishment law to be unconstitutional, based on the case of an inmate at the Oswald Correctional Facility who asked to be stoned to death. The justices declared such an execution would be cruel and unusual punishment, well outside the bounds of the state's prospect.
Governor, there's something going back and forth.
My support for the death penalty is unwavering. However, the public's reaction to this incident indicates that we should take this opportunity to step back. We must consider not only the means by which we determine such a sentence, but the ways in which we implement it. I'm therefore putting together a nonpartisan committee to re-examine all aspects of the death penalty.
Hey, Giles, what's going on? I thought you were halfway to dead.
No. Alive, alive.
Alive.
Act 4 then opens on M City, where Ryan is bouncing up the stairs on his way to talk with Murphy. Just before he gets there, his pace decreases and he puts on his poorly voice, saying that he needs to go to the hospital due to his throat being sore. Murphy's noticed that Ryan has been getting sick an awful lot lately, Ryan blaming it on the winter weather, but Murphy tells him that Gloria isn't in today. As if by magic, Ryan's throat makes a miraculous recovery, as he then asks about going to meet with Cyril in protective custody. We cut to protective custody where Cyril is being spoken at by fellow inmate Henry Stanton, who's over in his cell doing press-ups, and is played by Thomas G. Waits. Not to be confused with a similarly named American musician Tom Waits, although the two of them have performed together on occasion, Thomas G. Waits was born January 8, 1955 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, attending Bishop Egan High School in Furnace Hills before receiving a scholarship at New York's Juilliard School, where he studied drama between 1974 and 1977. Thomas earned a BA degree in writing from the New School in New York City, as well as a Master of Fine Arts in playwriting from the University of Iowa. Making his acting debut in 1976, Thomas appeared in Bill Jersey's Pity the Poor Soldier, the film which has since been renamed The Other Side of Victory. Despite being offered double his fee to appear in the film Snowbound that same year, Thomas took the role due to it being a celebration of the centennial of the American Revolutionary War. Thomas would appear in On the Yard in 1978, while in 1979 he appeared as Fox in Walter Hill's cult classic The Warriors, an excellent movie that I thoroughly recommend if you've never seen it. Arrow Video released an excellent 4K edition of the film last year. I absolutely recommend you pick it up. Make sure that you watch the theatrical cut if you can, as opposed to the director's cut though, as that's a bit ropey due to some odd creative choices. Thomas' experience on the film was somewhat tainted, however, and following a dispute with the director, asked for his name to be removed from the film's billing, a decision that Thomas has since stated he regrets. Also in 1979, Thomas would appear in Injustice for All, appearing alongside Al Pacino. The two actors formed a great friendship on set, which led to them appearing together on the theatre stage in Richard III. In 1982, Thomas beat previous guest director on Oz Matt Dillon as well as Kevin Bacon for the role of Bobby in David Mamet's American Buffalo. Thomas' portrayal of the character was seen by both Kurt Russell and the actual John Carpenter, who cast Thomas in the role of Windows in his seminal horror The Thing. If you've never seen The Thing, then you probably haven't lived. It's John Carpenter's best film by a long way, and probably in my personal top 5 films ever. Following the success of the film, Thomas took a short break from acting to form the band The Push-Ups, playing noted clubs such as CBGB's, Limelight and Trax, as well as opening for The Smithereens. In 1983, Thomas joined the Mirror Theatre's repertory company, performing in a number of off-Broadway productions, the highlight of which was his portrayal of Cupid in a production of Paradise Lost. Following appearances in the TV movies O'Malley and The Face of Rage, Thomas would make his TV acting debut in 1985, appearing in one episode of Miami Vice. Throughout the remainder of the 1980s, Thomas earned TV credits for shows including Crime Story, The Equalizer and Another World, as well as film credits for Light of Day and Shakedown. During this time, Thomas moved to Iowa to pursue a career as a playwright, where he completed work on the play Dark Laughter. In 1990, Thomas appeared on TV for one episode of True Blue along with the film State of Grace, while in 1991 he appeared as Gil in the film McBain, which sadly doesn't feature Renee Wolfcastle in the lead role. Thomas continued to act on screen throughout the 90s in the films Money Train, Time Lock and Rites of Passage, as well as on TV for shows such as Sliders, NYPD Blue, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, after which he moved back to New York to open his TWG acting school before appearing here on Oz. I did manage to make contact with Thomas a couple of months back, and I did promise that I would mention his film Target, which he produced, wrote and directed, and which can be found on Amazon Prime, so do go and give it a watch. So Henry is talking at Cyril, not talking to him. This is the very definition of a one-way conversation, bad-mouthing his ex-wife and her new boyfriend, and even getting in an anti-Semitic slur for good measure, and how she's turned the Weans against him. Luckily for Cyril, Ryan arrives on the scene to save him from Henry's tirade, Ryan doing a very cute hide-behind-the-concrete-pillar moment which Cyril really enjoys. Another good example of not only their brotherly bond, but of Cyril being very childlike. They share a hug as Cyril asks when he can leave protective custody, but Ryan admits that he doesn't know for sure and that Gloria has said that she'll help them, but that she's gone for now, and that they'll get to work on getting Cyril back to M-City as soon as she's back. Ryan takes a look around and mentions about how protective custody sucks and how it's no wonder Cyril is lonely, but Cyril disagrees, mentioning that he's not lonely now that Henry is there, which is Henry's cue to introduce himself to Ryan and how Cyril has told him all about him. Ryan whispers to Cyril about what he's said to Henry, but super sensitive of hearing Henry says that he hasn't been told anything incriminating, Ryan telling him that's a good thing, as his outlook is that if a guy is in protective custody then chances are he's ratted out his friends. But Henry tells him that he's in there due to being threatened by one of the Aryans, although he doesn't specify which one, saying that they threaten to separate him from his genitals. Ryan buys Henry's story for now, but tells Cyril not to go blabbing about their business. Cyril saying that he won't, but that Henry's also nice, so it'll probably be fine. Henry tries to get back into the conversation, saying that he likes Cyril, but Ryan tells him to keep it to himself. Henry finally taking the hint as they all separate and we cut to the kitchen where Ryan is prepping some food. He gets spooked by Claire, who does an excellent job of sneaking up on him from behind. But she tells him to calm down and that just because they're not fucking anymore doesn't mean they can't be friends. And she mentions that she's heard about Cyril being shipped off to the Connolly Institute. Ryan pointing out, yeah, because of you, referencing the so-called attack from Cyril last episode. Claire offers Ryan a deal, saying that she'll tell Leo not to transfer Cyril if Ryan tells Cyril that he should let Claire fuck him. Ryan doesn't go for this offer, shocking I know, saying that he doesn't want her anywhere near his brother. Claire tells him, fine, if I don't go near him, then neither do you, as Ryan calls her a sick bitch as he leaves with his bus tray of meals. He arrives at Unit J, referencing and howling like Deputy Dog, a cartoon that ran in the early 60s, and mentions that things are pretty quiet in Unit J these days following Johnny's death and Clayton's transfer to solitary, Alvin saying it's just him and Her Highness, and how being with her is like being shackled to the Bride of Frankenstein. A reference to the 1935 film of the same name, and one which I doubt that Ryan or possibly even Alvin himself would have even seen. Taking note of Alvin's fondness for Claire, Ryan asks how he'd like to earn some extra victuals, some chocolate bars perhaps, or maybe even some Newman's Own popcorn for his microwave, and says that all he has to do is make sure that Claire has a little accident, nudge nudge wink wink. Alvin says that he isn't a killer, which isn't what Ryan says he was implying, something which might teach him not to be so needlessly ambiguous, and that all he wants is for her to have a busted arm or a leg, something along those lines, just something to take her out of the picture for the time being. Claire enters the scene from her cupboard office asking if Ryan is about done, as Alvin gives him a wink to seal the deal. As Ryan leaves and Alvin sits down to have his meal and drink his oddly blue-coloured liquid that claims to be some kind of juice. Later in the day, Alvin has been escorted by Claire somewhere? Not really sure where they're going or why they're going there, but wherever it is they're off to, they need to go through one of the stairwells, stair 8 to be specific, and as Claire begins her descent, Alvin shunts her with his hip, which causes Claire to take a massive bump like a soccer player trying to get a free kick. Seriously, Alvin barely touches her and she launches herself down these stairs. It's fucking hilarious. Alvin says to himself that maybe he got lucky and that Claire is actually dead, before meekly calling for help. That kind of old-timey cartoon damsel in distress, help! Help! Kind of shouting. He does adopt a touch more seriousness to his tone as he goes down to check on her. But we cut to M City where Liam Meaney, who's been a background player for quite a while now after first appearing back in Series 3, informs Ryan that Claire has a broken pelvis. Ryan giving a sarcastic thrust in response as well as crying some invisible tears. Depending how serious a break Claire has suffered here, a broken pelvis will usually heal itself over the course of 4 to 6 weeks if it's just a stress fracture, while more serious breaks may require surgery and put someone out of action for up to 6 months for a full recovery. So Ryan has got exactly what he wanted and gotten Claire out of the picture for the time being. The pair notice a passing Porrig as Ryan asks how Liam is getting on with his new cellmate, Porrig having taken Keller's place in the pod following his transfer to Boston. Liam calls Porrig an arse and how he's told Liam that he isn't true Irish, Ryan saying that he's done the same to him, but tells Liam not to worry and that Porrig will come around. As Liam goes to leave, Ryan tells him to find out what he can about Henry, Liam telling him no problem as they fist bump to leave. Liam hasn't been seen that much on the show. As I said a moment ago, he is very much a background character, but this did a good job of establishing Liam as a loyal soldier to Ryan, I felt. You don't always need something grand or an elaborate moment to illustrate it. Sometimes less is more. Cut to the cafeteria where Jim and Timmy are putting a beating on Porrig. Very different to what occurred previously between them when Porrig was able to handle his own against them in the gym. I've come around on this having taken a look at it again. At first I felt like it completely undid what they set up before of Porrig being able to handle himself. But on reflection, if you were jumped from behind, even the most skilled of fighters can struggle when the numbers are against them like they are here. They somehow managed to take this fight to behind the curtain on the raised area at the back of the room. And no one else seems to bat an eyelid that this fight is going on. Usually when either the most minor of scuffles breaks out, everyone is crowding round trying to catch even a fleeting glimpse of the action. But no one seems remotely interested in this one for some reason. Well, there is one person actually, as Ryan arrives on the scene. Not quite sure why he was going behind the curtain there. And he gets into Timmy's face after Timmy tells him that it's none of his concern. Jim tells Ryan, come on, motherfucker, but Ryan is wise enough not to take a swing at Jim. That wouldn't end well for Ryan at all. But it turns out that he doesn't need to do anything as he has God on his side and he motions towards the curtain, signalling the arrival of Cloutier, who tells Timmy to meet him in the library and that he'll speak with Jim later on, as he then crouches down and extends his hand to Porrig, offering his apologies. Porrig gets to his feet but doesn't take the handshake. Instead dusting himself down as he heads over to tell Ryan that he's beholden to him, as we cut to the library where Cloutier has some words for Timmy.
First you had Samuel Goujon beaten, now Porrick Conley, both against my wishes.
I am doing the Lord's work in the best way I know how.
When you came to me and you asked to convert, I thought you meant you wanted to put those ways behind you, but I can see now that I was wrong. You are no longer a member of my congregation.
What?
I cast thee out.
You can't.
Let me go, please. Let me go.
Back in M City, Porrig is telling Ryan and Liam about the murder of 14 Catholics that occurred on January 30th, 1972, an event known historically as either the Bogside Massacre or perhaps more famously Bloody Sunday, which Porrig mentions here and how his mother was one of the 14 killed. I won't go into details of that event here, as not only would that be pretty heavy going, it would steer us off course completely. But what this tells us is that Porrig could be from Londonderry in Northern Ireland, although it's never confirmed one way or another. It also lends itself to Porrig's claims of Liam and Ryan not being quote-unquote true Irish. While both men would have been quite young at the time of the event, if we use Dean Winter's real-world age as an example, he would have only been 5 at the time, but if Ryan was serious about his Irish roots, something which Murphy called him out back on in Series 3, then he should at least be aware of this event. Porrig telling him about it here would suggest that he isn't, however. The alarm sounds to indicate the start of visiting hours as Ryan heads off for a visit with Suzanne, Porrig asking whether or not Ryan treats his mother right. as Ryan explains that they've only recently found each other after having been separated when he was a baby. But he does says that he treats her right, something which would make Mr. T very proud, and I genuinely can't believe that I've managed to work in a reference to Mr. T's Treat Your Mother Right into this episode. See, this is the kind of shit that goes around in my brain. It's a minefield of total nonsense sometimes. Cut to Ryan meeting with Suzanne then, and Suzanne is talking about how she struggled to find the words to truly explain her reasonings for giving Ryan away. She says that the 60s were a mixed up time, and how she was living in a cold water flat near the university, something which probably hasn't changed all that much in the time since if my memories of student accommodation are accurate. She admits that she just did what was expected of a woman back in those days, but mentions that the streets were on fire with protests, particularly protesting the war in Vietnam, which Ryan mentions. Suzanne saying that she would carry Ryan out into the crowd to listen to the speeches, and that one day things just clicked and she knew she had to join. To compare this to a Simpsons episode, this is a very similar plotline to Homer's mother Mona leaving him when he was a young age. Ryan asks her why she didn't take him with her, Suzanne saying that she and her friends fought for peace and were in fact quite militant, something which resulted in someone getting killed. So clearly she made the right choice by not bringing a young child along with her as part of her crusade, and that following the killing Suzanne ran and continued to do so for years, but has decided to stop the marathon after 35 years in order to turn herself in. Straight away Ryan looks concerned, which is understandable, he's only just got this person back into his life. Her going away again would put an immediate halt to them building a relationship. But Suzanne isn't sure exactly what will happen to her, or if she'll even go to prison as a result. That would all depend on what crime Suzanne has committed exactly, as well as the statute of limitations, as they can vary. Ryan pleads with Suzanne not to give herself up, but Suzanne says that she has to, saying that she's no good to him unless she's true to who she is, as Ryan changes tactic and reveals his plan to escape Oz along with Cyril, and proposes that they all leave together and build a new life. Suzanne is against the plan though, telling Ryan that he'll spend the rest of his life doing what she's done, hiding and lying and living in fear and denying who he is, and says that that's a life without meaning, and that a life without meaning is no life at all. She does lay it on pretty thick here, but she does have a valid point along with the fact that she's literally just told Ryan that she's been on the run for 35 years and has had enough of running. And then you have the Cyril factor. I don't mean to sound too harsh on the poor guy, but if you're entering into a situation where you need to keep up appearances of pretending to be someone that you're not, someone in Cyril's condition is going to be a hindrance to that. One of the things that appeals to fans about Ryan is that he is cunning with his plans, oftentimes able to meticulously plan in advance, especially when he relies so heavily on manipulation tactics. There are times, however, where he has a tendency to panic and not plan things in his usual way, and this seems to be one of those instances. He even admits that he wasn't planning on telling Suzanne about his escape plan at this point in time, but her revelation about turning herself in has made him tell her sooner than he wanted to. The buzzer sounds to end the visit and the two of them hug, as Ryan calls Suzanne mum for the first time, and she tells him that she loves him and that she always has and always will, the pair of them going their separate ways with tears in their eyes. The visiting room gets an instantaneous transformation into the interview room. This is clearly the same room that we've just been in, only shot from a different angle, where Porrick meets with Arnold Zeldman. Arnold comes with bad news, explaining that the Attorney General has circumvented the law of asylum and hands Porrick his notice of deportation, and that a week from today he'll be standing before a British judge. Porrick is under the impression that he won't receive a fair trial and that he'll hang, which isn't true, at least not from a genuine legal perspective. While Britain didn't officially abolish the death penalty until 1998 as part of the Human Rights Act, the last people executed by hanging in the UK were Peter Anthony Allen and Gwyn Owen Evans, who were hanged on August 13, 1964. Arnold isn't exactly helpful to Porrick's pleas. He kind of just holds his hands up as if to say, meh, what you gonna do? He's either checked out completely or knows that his hands are tied due to the ruling of the Attorney General, as we cut to a flashback of Ryan confessing to Gloria about murdering Patrick Keenan, the blue colour filter making the pair of them look like a couple of Smurfs, as Gloria has Keenan's cross in her hand as Ryan arrives. Gloria asks about Cyril, Ryan saying that he's looking forward to getting out of protective custody, but he puts a swift end to the pleasantries and gets things back to business. That being, what is Gloria's decision regarding helping him and Cyril escape? Gloria admits that she's been having sleepless nights due to Ryan's little proposition. When Ryan asks her for a decision, she takes him aside and gives him back Keenan's shamrock. Wondering why Gloria is giving this back to him, she informs him that a little over 10 minutes ago, Leo had asked her if she knew anything about Keenan's death. Ryan looking a little panicked, but Gloria says that she lied and said no. Ryan, obviously very pleased at hearing that as it keeps him in the clear, doesn't seem to grasp the point of what Gloria is saying. Gloria telling him that the medical board is currently deliberating as to whether or not she's qualified to hold her job, specifically questioning her ethics. She admits that her initial reaction was, well, how could they do that? But having thought it over, she's beginning to ask the same question of herself. Continuing to put himself first and foremost, Ryan tells her that love is more important than ethics. Gloria calling him on that, asking him, how the fuck would you know? Well, not exactly that, I'm paraphrasing, but that's the sentiment behind it. She tells him, your ethics, the few that you have, are completely screwed up, and that she should tell Leo the truth. But for some reason, and God help her, she won't, and tells Ryan that she is not going to help him escape, and that if he asks her again, she'll tell Leo everything. She does actually do a decent job of taking back control of the situation here, although the fact that she was ever considering helping Ryan in the first place is still confusing as hell to me. She calls for an officer to take Ryan back to M-City as Ryan tells her that he does have ethics and that he isn't screwed up, as we go back to M-City where Ryan knocks on Porrig's pod for a chat. Porrig asks what Ryan wants, and Ryan tells him that he's been on the computer reading about the Troubles, a term which I always feel somewhat downplays the hostilities in Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. It seems to make things sound like they weren't as bad as they actually were, almost making it all sound like some kind of minor inconvenience. I will say, though, fair play to Ryan here. He's had Porrig accuse him of not being true Irish due to not knowing his history, so he's actually gone and done something to try and bring himself up to speed. Boiling the Troubles down to some quick bullet points, saying the whole thing isn't about religion at all, but actually about money and land, he asks how can Porrig not hit the British, and that if he has any balls at all, then Porrig better be IRA, fighting for what's rightfully his. Which, fucking hell, steady on, Ryan. I know this stuff is fresh in your memory, but let's be careful now. Porrig seems to share that sentiment, asking what Ryan's newfound knowledge and enthusiasm do for either of them. Ryan saying that he wants to be part of something that matters. Porrig sniggers at that, which annoys Ryan, but Porrig can see that Ryan is worked up having just read about all of this stuff. He isn't deep into it or have the same kind of connection to it all that he does, but Ryan tells him that people in Oz know that he gets things done, even calling it his talent. I mean, that's at best a half-truth. Ryan has been involved in getting things done, but he always tends to get someone else to do the actual dirty work. And he asks for Porrig to allow him to do something for the cause. Porrig takes a look around the unit, Burr, Chucky and the Muslims seeming quite prominent in his vision, and he tells Ryan, alright then, and that he knows what they should do. They meet up later on in the laundry room where Ryan has underneath his dirty clothes snuck past some bottles of bleach, 2 gallons of the stuff to be exact. Making a crack about Porrig's whites all being clean, which was pretty funny as I don't think we've seen Porrig out of his green jumper since he arrived, Ryan asks why Porrig needed the bleach so badly. Porrig asks whether or not Ryan can get hold of a wristwatch, which knowing Ryan he probably can do, but the question throws Ryan as he asks Porrig why. Porrig forces Ryan back against the washing machine as he holds a blade to Ryan's throat, as he asks Ryan if he's willing to die with him. A hesitant Ryan eventually sort of says yes, probably because he's realised that he's got himself into a situation that's way over his head. All of a sudden that you better be IRA pep talk doesn't seem such a clever move. Porrig tells him that the bleach and the wristwatch are part of his grand scheme, which sounds much more Bond villain than real world terrorist, and that he intends to build a bomb and that they, Porrig and Ryan, are going to blow up M-City. As Ryan shows a mixture of concern and confusion, Augustus monologues that in order to experience victory in any sport you need teamwork. But that teamwork is also the scariest notion a person can face, and that joining a team means that you give up part of your individuality, being willing to sacrifice whatever is necessary for the greater cause, and that if you're willing to do that in order to be a team player, then success will follow. He does offer a word of caution, however, that being that you should be sure that the success you go after is the success you need. The whole thing plays out with different groups of men in different uniforms standing behind him, emerging from the darkness one by one. First we have a football team, wearing blue uniforms similar to Tom Fontana's beloved Buffalo Bills, who are followed by the staff, who in turn make way for a group of inmates, who are then followed by people in army fatigues, with the final group being a group of terrorists decked out in all black with balaclavas. A referee's whistle signals the end of the monologue as well as the episode, as the credits roll.
Hey. Two gallons of bleach.
Good.
All your whites are clean, so you gonna tell me now why you need this stuff so bad?
Can you get me a wristwatch?
Wristwatch? Why?
Ah! Colin, what the fuck are you doing?
Would you be willing to die with me? Would you?
Bleach and the wristwatch are part of my grand scheme.
Which is what?
To make a bomb. You and me, O'Reilly. We're gonna blow up Emerald City.
In any sport, to experience victory, the one element you need more than any other is teamwork. But teamwork is also the scariest notion a person can face. Joining a team means giving up part of your individuality, being willing to make whatever sacrifice is necessary for the greater cause. If you're willing to do these things to truly become a team player, then success will follow. But a word of caution. Be sure that the success you go after is the success you need.
So there you have it, Season 4, Episode 15, Even the Score. I think it's safe to say that Series 4B has been a bit bleh overall. It's had okay moments, but those have been few and far between. We've spoken at length about the reduced writing and filming schedule, and this episode really felt like the most affected by those factors. There just isn't a whole lot of anything going on here, almost to the point that it's a borderline skippable episode. I wouldn't say it's entirely skippable, but you could have cut the whole episode down to probably around 20 minutes and be in the exact same place at the end. That could explain why it's taken me so long to put this episode together, feeling the need to just try and salvage something out of it. But to be totally honest with you, this was a real struggle. It's not a total disaster. The segment with Beecher and the Rockwells was well acted by everyone involved, and it was nice to see some new camera movements in that scene. The show's style is so ingrained by this point that it's nice to have something new thrown in there from time to time. The same can be said about the little montage we got following Saeed's beatdown of Robson. That did a nice job of clearly illustrating exactly where we were at that stage in that story. Other than that, however, there's a whole lot of not much else that stays in the memory. In fact, I had to do a complete rewatch of this episode even after writing my notes to truly put into words how I felt about it, which I've never had to do before. Normally, I know where I stand with an episode after two watches, the first one being a full run-through, with the second one being where I take my notes. But never before have I had to go back for a third time just to remind myself what actually did or didn't happen. The second game in the basketball series is a textbook example of filling time, and the attack on Dave was a hefty dose of grim just for the sake of it. Obviously, we're now going to a third game in the series, because we clearly need to pad things out that little bit further. But what would have been wrong with having Dave and McManus just lose? Now, I know what you're thinking. Come on, Neil, you've watched the show for long enough now. You should have known that something awful was going to happen. But the crux of that story is humbling McManus' ego, not shattering Dave's dream of playing basketball. Them losing the series fair and square, if anything, would have been against the grain and the exact opposite of what we as an audience have come to expect from the show. The segment involving the Homeboys and Supreme was just kind of there, and I'd forgotten how sudden Tug's departure from the show was. I had it in my mind that he was around for much longer than what he turned out to be. But the inmates' court segment was quite enjoyable for what it was, and Poet's Three Disses line is one of the show's more iconic ones, so at least it gave us that. It's always great to see Devlin, even if he is a monumental piece of shit, but again, it was in a whole section that just didn't progress anything. Giles on death row, with his desire to be stoned to death, tying up the courts as to its legalities and its ethics, is an interesting comment on the US legal system and capital punishment. And having that story continue into series 5, which would have most likely seen some passage of time occur, adds weight to its complexity. Instead, Devlin comes back, stops the whole thing in its tracks, and Giles winds up back in solitary right where he started when we first met him back in series 2. He's literally gone full circle here. The closing stretch revolving around Ryan was probably the only other real highlight in this episode, which when you take into account my opinion of Dean Winter's acting ability, really speaks volumes. Claire taking a tumble down the stairs was comedy gold, and Gloria finally came to her senses in telling Ryan to fuck off with his escape plan. But his newfound partnership with Porrig quickly went from blooming to teetering on a knife edge with Porrig's grand scheme of blowing up M-City with a bomb. Cliché though it may be to have the one genuine Irishman on the show be a bomb-crazy terrorist, which was the style at the time for most Irish characters on film and TV at the turn of the century, it at least set up the finale very well. We're going into that knowing that something is brewing, and is something which stands to change ours completely. Is it the worst episode of the show? That's hard to say, especially with where we'll go with certain things in the future, but it's probably the most unnecessary episode we've had so far, with the good points loading up the front and the rear of things, bookending a whole lot of inconsequential stuff in between.
Get the fuck out of my office.
Two deleted scenes to talk about for this episode, the first of which sees Morales and Chucky approaching Supreme while he's working out in the gym, asking about whether or not he's changed his mind about murdering Burr. Supreme assures the two of them that his strategy is in motion, and as he told them previously, he's gonna get Augustus to kill Burr. Morales and Chucky leave as Supreme goes back to his workout. The second scene takes place in the staff break room where Leo is grabbing himself a slice of what looks like some kind of lemon drizzle cake. A heroically sized slice, I might add. Leo is a man after my own heart when it comes to cake, it would seem. When Gloria enters and he asks how she's feeling, Gloria telling him that she's due to hear where she stands with regards to her medical license the following week. Leo tells her that his fingers are crossed, which was a nice touch from him. It's not often that we actually get to see the human side of him rather than him having to constantly be the warden. But before Gloria leaves, he tells her that he's in the middle of investigating the Patrick Keenan murder, Gloria mentioning that she'd heard about an informant implicating Ryan. Leo reveals Arif as being the informant, mentioning that he sees Arif as being reliable, and asks Gloria about whether or not Ryan, due to his feelings for her, might have exacted revenge on Keenan for raping Gloria. He asks if Gloria has any information that might help, but Gloria does a good enough job of convincing Leo otherwise, saying that she was stunned when Keenan's body was found and that Ryan never implicated himself at any point as the scene closes. The first scene, literally no reason to exist whatsoever. It adds absolutely nothing and is a complete waste of time even bothering to film. Whereas the second one could have possibly gone in, but also doesn't really change anything having not been included. Had it been included, it would have tied into the scene in which Gloria rejects Ryan's escape proposal. She practically includes it herself anyway when she tells Ryan about lying to Leo, which has led to her questioning her own ethics, which is probably why it wasn't included. But to actually see that scene between her and Leo, to actually show that Leo is on the trail as well as showing that human side to him that I mentioned, all good enough reasons to have included it in the episode. Would its inclusion have changed anything? Not likely, which if that's the case, then it's probably better to cut it. But that first one, Jesus Christ, why even bother? With a death toll of 1 for this episode, it's time to say goodbye to Tug Daniels, played by Method Man. We also say goodbye to Mrs. Rockwell, played by Catherine Maisel. Following his run on Oz, Method Man has continued to work as a recording artist, releasing a further 5 solo albums, with his most recent being 2022's Meth Lab Session 3, The Rehab, as well as a number of collaboration albums with other artists. He's also continued to work as a member of Wu-Tang Clan, with the collective releasing a further 4 studio albums between 2001 and 2015, with the group's most recent release being the 2019 EP, Wu-Tang of Mics and Men. Method Man has also produced a series of comic books based on the group for Hatchet Book Group, and even entered the podcasting realm in 2021 as the hub of Marvel Method, a series in which Method Man and celebrity guests discuss Marvel comics, as well as other pop culture issues. If you're listening, Method Man, and I'm sure you are, of course, feel free to drop me an email at insideoarspodcast@gmail.com to arrange my appearance on the show. In addition to his music ventures, Method Man has also continued to act, with credits on film including 2001's How High, in which he starred alongside his longtime collaborative partner Redman, as well as Brown Sugar and Scary Movie 3 in 2002 and 2003 respectively, while in 2005 he appeared in Venom, which coincidentally is not based on the Marvel Comics character, with more recent credits including 2019's Shaft, where he appeared as Freddy P, while in 2022 he appeared in Last Looks and On the Come Up. In addition to his film credits, Method Man has also continued to act on TV, with credits for shows such as Third Watch, Boston Public, and like a number of his Oz co-stars, he appeared in a recurring role on The Wire, appearing as Melvin Wagstaff for a total of 13 episodes between the show's second and fifth seasons. Method Man also earned his first writing credit in 2002 for the TV movie Stung. In 2004, Method Man partnered again with Redman on the sitcom Method and Red for Fox Television, which the pair also wrote and produced. Originally scheduled for 13 episodes, the show was cancelled early, leaving 4 episodes unaired following a number of disputes between the pair and the studio about the direction of the show, as well as Method Man being critical of Fox adding a laugh track to the recordings. So displeased were they with the studio's interference, Method Man and Redman disowned the show completely, even going so far as to tell people to not even bother watching it. Appearing mostly in guest starring roles, often as himself, Method Man has also had recurring roles on shows such as Chosen, where he has provided the voice of Phantasm, as well as Blue Bloods, where he appeared as Mario Hunt for 3 episodes, as well as The Breaks and Rebel. His most recent acting credit includes 30 episodes of the TV series Power Book 2 Ghost, with his most recent film credit coming for the recently released How I Learned to Fly, which has been met with critical acclaim. At the time of recording, Method Man is scheduled to appear in the films Shadow Force, Bad Shabbos, and Trouble Man, all of which are listed as being in post-production, as well as the 430 movie, which is currently listed as being in pre-production. Method Man also continues to perform with Wu-Tang Clan, with the group having recently completed a Las Vegas residency, with an upcoming appearance at the Kilby Block Party scheduled for May of this year. Life has also imitated art for Method Man due to a number of brushes with the law, most notably in 2007 when he was arrested for marijuana possession. After his SUV was pulled over near New York's Battery Tunnel, one source was reported as stating, quote, "It was like something out of Cheech and Chong. He rolls down the window and the smoke would choke a horse," end quote. After a shakedown of his vehicle, which yielded 2 blunts as well as a plastic bag containing his pot, Method Man was charged with unlawful possession of marijuana, criminal possession of marijuana, not really sure what the difference between those two charges is, driving whilst intoxicated, and driving an uninspected motor vehicle. Method Man would reach a plea agreement with the city to perform community service in lieu of jail time, which saw him rapping to children about the dangers of drugs. In 2009, Method Man was arrested at his Staten Island home on charges of income tax violation, having failed to file income tax returns between 2004 and 2007 amounting to $33,000. Method Man pled guilty to tax evasion and was sentenced to a conditional discharge, as well as paying a $106,000 fine. While his time as Tug Daniels might have come to an end, we will talk about Method Man in relation to Oz again in the future, but that's a story for another time. Following a final appearance here on Oz, Catherine Maisel appeared in the 2001 film Down, playing the part of Mildred, before returning to TV to earn credits on shows such as Without a Trace, CSI Miami, Bones, Body of Proof, and also returned to Law & Order Special Victims Unit in a different role along with recurring roles on shows including NYPD Blue, Damages, and Grey's Anatomy. The most recent credit came in 2017 for the role of Mrs. Hallett in the film The Greatest Showman. The Oz One and Done Club gave out 4 new memberships for this episode, with memberships for the mystery actor that played the Sacramento Kings talent scout, Bill Boggs for helping out on Up Your Ante, and Peter Dinklage as he took a tumble off a building. The most notable though was for Dave Rockwell, played by Alex Webb. Following his appearance here on Oz, Alex has continued to act mostly in minor roles on TV, with credits for shows including Boardwalk Empire, House of Cards, Daredevil, and Blindspot, as well as being a recurring performer on Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. Alex has also appeared in, written, and directed a number of short films, such as 2004's The Girls in 2C, 2009's Hove, The Wind, and 2017's To the Flame. At the time of recording, Alex is listed as appearing as Mayor Nichols in the film Friendship, which is currently listed as being in pre-production. My episode MVP, and this was possibly the hardest one that I've ever had to pick because there was really not a whole lot going on for so much of this episode. But I'm gonna give it to Gloria for finally coming to her senses and denying Ryan's request to help him and Cyril escape. The scene between Beecher and the Rockwells was very well acted, but it doesn't do much else in regards to the rest of the episode. It's very much focused on whether or not the Rockwells are going to pose any sort of threat to Beecher's upcoming parole. There isn't anything else on the line as far as other characters go, whereas the Ryan-Gloria situation has further reaching consequences in that it could potentially see the exit of two inmates, as well as a staff member. The fact that it's taken Gloria this long to actually come to a decision is still somewhat baffling. She's well aware of Ryan's twisted idea of the concept of love and knows full well he's only ever looking out for himself, so why she was even considering helping him will always remain a mystery, especially considering what it would mean for her career should she get caught. I mentioned in a previous episode that having her medical license in the state revoked isn't necessarily, to borrow a term, a life sentence. There are other avenues in which he can be involved in the medical world, but helping two inmates escape is far too much of a risk when there is still that uncertainty. And quite frankly, any decision other than a no would have made Gloria look like a complete idiot, considering she understands Ryan's shortcomings and until recently she thought he was capable of arranging to have her sexually assaulted. So for that extremely flimsy reason, Gloria takes the episode MVP. If you need to catch up on any episodes of the podcast, you can do so over on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Castbox, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, depending on where you are in the world, or wherever you get your podcasts from. There you will find the first three series of Inside Oz, as well as what we've covered in Series 4 so far, and you will also find the Outside Oz bonus episodes as well. Subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode, leave a 5-star review wherever you can to help with exposure for the podcast, and if you have any Oz-related or non-related questions or comments, you can get in touch with the show by emailing insideozpodcast@gmail.com or on social media or on Instagram, where you can get all the updates about the podcast by following the handle at insideozpodcast. You can still follow the show by following the handle at insideozpodcast on Twitter. I know that it's been called X for quite some time now, but I've still yet to meet anybody that actually calls it that. And you can also follow the show on Threads. Simply search Inside Oz Podcast on there to find the feed, and you can also follow the show on Mastodon by following the handle at insideozpodcast@mastodon.world and see whether or not I actually remember to use it. Next time on Inside Oz, be careful what you say as they could be your Series 4 Episode 16, Famous Last Words, where Augustus discovers where his allegiances lie, Morales and Edward conduct some maintenance, Cloutier is a shepherd without a flock, the basketball series reaches its conclusion, and Beecher learns the outcome of his parole hearing. All of this and more as we finally reach the explosive Series 4 finale, but until then, I have been Neil Thompson, and I will catch you on the next episode of Inside Oz, the original Oz Review Podcast. Catch you later, everyone.
Jack, you have to take off your shoes.
Yeah, well, you're so skinny, your eyes are in single file.
Well, you're so ugly, your ears stick out to get away from your face.
Well, your mama is
Hold it, wait a minute. Don't bring anyone mother into this. She ain't here. If it wasn't for your mother, you wouldn't be here. So remember, when you put down one mother, you put down mothers all over the world.
Miserable groan from the pain that she felt when I was born.
was for the oven with its burning heat, where she stood making sure I had something to eat. T is for the time that she stayed up at night and took my temperature when I wasn't feeling right. X is for the hard-earned money she spent to keep clothes on my back and try to pay the rent. E is every wrinkle I put on her face and every worry that I caused when I stayed out late. The last letter R is that she taught me respect, and for the room up in heaven that I know she'll get. Mother, there is no other like mother, so treat her right. Mother, I always love her, my mother, so treat her right, treat her right.